Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. This is a recording I am making on the early hours of the 4th of April, 2013. It's not actually a nav briefing. I'm calling it a digression from a nav briefing, number 56, Breakthrough with Dhumavati. And this digression, or commentary, if you will, concerns the matter of the Diamond Sutra. At this very moment, here in Spain, as I'm coming through my experience with the grief therapist, Dhumavati, it's raining heavily, as it does rain off and on in the winters here. Winter is the rainy season. So I'm up late at night. The cats are sleeping on the day bed in the writing room. And it's raining outside. Sometimes it rains torrentially. It rarely rains lightly. Winter in Andalusia consists of sporadic events of torrential rain. And this winter is proving to be very wet and therefore carries the promise of a spectacular flowering in spring. In fact, the flowering of spring has already begun. So at this particular springtime moment, under the heavy rains of the evening, I thought I would add a commentary to some of the recent briefings regarding the teaching on pretenses to be found in the Diamond Sutra. Some of you may not be familiar with this material. Some of you may not care. Tibetan Buddhism or Mahayana Buddhism, which is the particular genre of interest in this context, may be completely out of your realm. And I wouldn't be surprised if you are bored with it and have no attraction to it whatsoever. I don't pretend, of course, or presume to be a Buddhist teacher. That's not one of my pretenses. In fact, I have the pretense to not be a Buddhist teacher. But there is something acutely and even poignantly relevant in Buddhist teachings regarding Dhumavati's activity of freeing us from pretenses. And there is something so poignant and compelling in this context that I feel a strong inclination to add this little commentary. So here we go. Two things I want to say to you about what is the so-called Prajnaparamita literature of Buddhism. The word Prajnaparamita is Sanskrit, of course, and it means supreme wisdom or supreme or transcendent knowledge. Paramita means supreme. Prajna means wisdom or spiritual knowledge. Now, this Prajnaparamita teaching, which is particularly associated with a strong feminine presence, that is to say, a feminine archetype of wisdom, Prajnaparamita is in fact a feminine archetype of wisdom in Buddhism. She is represented as such, the Prajnaparamita goddess. You will find images of her in association with this genre of Buddhist teaching. But of course, to those in planetary tantra, this is nothing other than the divine Sophia herself. So once again, the Sophia equals Vidya equation comes into play. So let's see if I can show you how this feminine archetype of wisdom, Prajnaparamita, comes into play exactly in planetary tantra as well. First of all, let me give you a little bit of a very brief historical overview. It can be said that the teachings of the Buddha, in quotes, derive from some things that were said by a person who lived historically around 550 BC, which is the exact midpoint of Kali Yuga, dated from 3102 BC to 2216. And then at that exact moment, at the midpoint of Kali Yuga, in linear time, historically speaking, there appears the figure of Gotama, or Shakyamuni, the sage of the Shakya clan, that is to say, an Indian prince who came to be known, who was known as Siddhartha, that was his given name, Prince Siddhartha, and who came to be known as the Enlightened One, the Buddha, Shakyamuni, and so forth. Now, I'd like to point out, historically, that whatever Siddhartha did in his lifetime has very little to do with what you see as Buddhism today. First of all, what you see as Buddhism today is an institution. But Buddhist historians all agree that the institutionalized or monastic form of Buddhism did not even take shape until somewhere between 600 and 800 years after Prince Siddhartha actually lived. So you find monastic institutionalized Buddhism in the form of a patriarchal, hierarchical, man-only affair appearing and taking form in around the 2nd century, 3rd century AD, okay? Previous to that, for 6 or 7 centuries, Buddhism was preserved in what is called the tradition of forest monks. That is to say, the Buddhist communities previous to the institutionalization of Buddhism simply consisted of wandering monks who lived in the forest and who gathered in associations in wild nature, who met and sat around in circles and congregations in nature, in the jungles, in the forests of India. And that was it. That was all there was to Buddhism until it began to be formalized and institutionalized. And that was due to a great degree, of course, to the literature that was used as the instrument and foundation for the institutionalization of the Buddha's teachings. So before I get to the subject of this literature and what was the literature that brought about this transformation of Buddhism, just picture in your minds for a moment the community or congregation of early Buddhists who over many centuries had no formal organization and no hierarchy and no masters and no levels of attainment, but simply gathered together in a forest setting, in a pastoral setting, and they sat there in their robes, in whatever they wore at the time, entirely moved from the villages and the urban centers of that epoch, and in their withdrawal from the world, in their forest communities and forest gatherings, dedicated themselves to rehash and interpret and develop and preserve the teachings that had been given verbally by Prince Siddhartha when he was acting as Buddha, the Enlightened One. Among these gatherings in these forest groves were a mingling of women. The written down history of those who assumed the responsibility for the institutionalization of Buddhism and who set up the hierarchical, patriarchal, monastic structure, in their account of Buddhism, they generally leave the women out. But in the forest gatherings and in the circle of disciples and followers intimately connected to the historical Buddha, there were women. I'll return to that point in a moment. But as the story came to be told, and as Buddhism morphed into a monastic system, the evidence of those women was eliminated. And in fact, Buddhism was largely set up to be a male-only game. And even though there are such things as Buddhist nuns, I mean, you have to admit, to be honest, you know, that women are allowed into Buddhism as a kind of token expression of tolerance and compassion. It's really a pose. It's quite fraudulent, because in fact, if you go back and you look at the foundational teachings of Buddhism by those other than Shakyamuni himself, you find that there's a considerable amount of masochism and rejection of and hatred of women in the earliest Buddhist teachings. Hence, the structure that has come down to us today, the decadent, crumbling, pathetic, and fraudulent structure of Buddhism, including at its summit Tibetan Buddhism, is largely a male affair. And to the extent that they include women, they include them to exploit them, or else to maintain the cover against the obvious fact that they are a male-only organization. It's like there are as many women in Buddhism as there are women capos in the mafia. That's about how it goes. So with that digression, within this digression, let me return for a moment to the question of the literature. Literature, which was not printed until the 9th century, by the way, literature that was simply copied down by scribes and recopied, of course, played a certain role in the evolution of Buddhism. It played a huge role, and massive amounts of literature were generated from the teachings actually given or alleged to have been given by the historical Buddha in the 6th century BC. Massive amounts in Pali and in Sanskrit. The Pali canon, the Sanskrit canon, later on the Tibetan canon. Okay? And up until about 850 AD, there was no actual printed, reprinted, reproduced, or block printed literature, but there was enormous body of literature in the form of handwritten manuscripts. The situation is similar to the one that occurred in the Middle Ages with scribes in Christian monasteries meticulously producing manuscripts, each one being an item on its own terms, each one being a handwritten, illuminated manuscript, which was not printed, okay? So we're talking about the era of the pre-print reproduction of Buddhist texts. And during this era, something happened around 150 or 200 AD that was quite remarkable and remains more or less inexplicable, even by Buddhist scholars on their own terms, that is, if they are willing to admit their ignorance. And that is the emergence of the Prajnaparamita teachings, which had an enormous role, in forming the Mahayana path of Buddhism. Originally, Buddhism was only of the Hinayana type, with a hidden tantric stream that was not written and that was not preserved in written form, but only orally preserved. So picture primordial Buddhism, Buddhism, as you will, as consisting of things written in the Pali script in the Hinayana genre and a hidden underground stream of oral teachings. What happened, and this was a momentous development, was that around 100 or 200 AD, other written teachings began to appear, including these sutras in the genre of Prajnaparamita literature. And these teachings were different. They had a different spin to them. They had something in them that scholars can't quite put their finger on. And the formulation of Mahayana Buddhism occurred under the influence of this mysterious and, to scholars, undetectable spin. What was this spin? Well, primarily, the spin reveals itself in the introduction through Mahayana Buddhism around 150 or 200 AD of the so-called ideal of the Bodhisattva. Up until that time, there had been the Buddha, and then there was the Bodhisattva. Okay? Well, hold on here. Like, what's the difference? Well, the Buddha is the individual, man or woman, who realizes the true nature of consciousness, who returns to the primordial foundation awareness of consciousness, thereby achieving nirvana, which means the extinction of all expressions of that consciousness, which is realized in the ultimate state of its own self-awakening. Well, what happens when you go into nirvana is you go into void, you go into passivity, you go into non-activity. So, any enlightened being who realizes nirvana, which literally means a lack of vibration, a lack of effect, goes into a void of non-expression and remains abiding and residing in the blissful state of superconsciousness known as samadhi, which is the highest nirvana, etc., etc. This story has been told thousands and thousands of times. For instance, in the recounting of the life of the historical Buddha, Prince Siddhartha or Shakyamuni, it is said that he achieved the state, or let's say, to be more precise, total access to the state of nirvana when he gained his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, that's a ficus, in Bodh Gaya. Well, fine. At that moment, he had a choice to allow himself to be completely absorbed in nirvana, in which case he would never have said a word or taught anything to anybody, or to come a little bit forward, as it were, out of nirvana toward the tonal, to stand on the threshold between the tonal and the perfect void of nirvana, and to present his teachings for the benefit of humanity, and then at the end of his life to achieve his ultimate nirvana by turning around again and going into that faceless, nameless void of total realization. Okay? This is often how scholars explain the commitment of the Buddha to teach during those years following his experience of enlightenment. Perhaps you can hear the thunder rolling outside, I don't know. Thunder is rolling across the Reed Valley here, very close by, and the rain is coming down. I'll open the window so you can hear the thunder. Hold on. Maybe you'll be able to pick it up in the background of my talk. So, all that is standard. All that is routine. It's something happened around 150, 200 AD that changed the whole orientation of the then existing Buddhist community of forest gathering monks. Changed their entire orientation toward the prospect of enlightenment. And that is the Bodhisattva ideal. And the Bodhisattva ideal goes like this. I have achieved enlightenment, Bodhi, awakening. And I have the option, as did Shakyamuni, to turn and go into the formless, nameless, wordless bliss of nirvana and to reside in the absolute, eternal, and incorruptible bliss of the ground awareness. But I choose not to do so. I choose rather to remain in samsara and to act in samsara and speak and present myself within the limitations of samsara, that is to say, the tonal, the ordinary world, for the benefit of all sentient beings. So the bodhisattva vow is to relinquish withdrawal into complete enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. It's not to relinquish enlightenment because, you know, enlightenment is not to be relinquished. So if you have reached enlightenment, if you have attained that state of ultimate self-knowing in the knowing of the primordial ground awareness from which any conception of yourself arises in the first place, then you can't relinquish it. It is always present. But you can act from that toward the world as someone who fosters the liberation of all sentient beings. And this is the bodhisattva vow, which is considered at was considered at that time and is still considered to have a particular spin of renunciation. That is to say, you renounce nirvana in order to remain in samsara so that you can contribute to the liberation of all sentient beings. This is the essence of the bodhisattva vow, introduced at that time in history in particular association with the definite rise and self-definition of Mahayana Buddhism. Okay? Now, I've pointed out on other occasions a simple historical fact that has also been noted, to their credit, by a few Buddhist scholars. And that fact goes like this. I'm going to call it a coincidence. Isn't it an interesting coincidence that at the very moment that the Mahayanist ideal of the bodhisattva was defined around 150-200 AD, and the Prajnaparamita literature emerged, and Mahayana Buddhism, the second vehicle, the greater vehicle, as it's called, came into definition. Isn't it a coincidence? Isn't it a matter of interest that that was exactly the historical moment that the first teleste of the Gnostic mysteries came forth in public to speak to the world at large? Isn't that an interesting coincidence? And I've also cited the historical records that show that King Asoka of India, already in the time of Alexander the Great, that is 5 centuries before Mahayana Buddhism emerged, presented an edict to the world that he would support the propagation of Buddhism to the far ends of the earth. And even at that time, 5 centuries before the moment that I'm speaking about, Buddhist sages and yogis and illuminated mystics from India were in Alexandria, and they were in Egypt, penetrating even to Luxor and to the great cities and spiritual communities of the south of Egypt, 400 to 500 years earlier. So what I want you to imagine, or picture if you can, is that there were at least 400 or 500 years of actual cultural cross-fertilization between the Gnostic mysteries, particularly of the Levant, that is to say, of the eastern Mediterranean areas, Syria, what are now Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, and the Far East. Alexander the Great made that connection in his lifetime in a triumphal march connected with his narcissistic fantasy of being a world ruler. But that connection already existed. The Silk Route was already there, and there already existed prior to Alexander's extension into India, which produced the Gandhava culture. There existed prior to that time already many links between the Mediterranean mystery schools and the mystical and yogic traditions of the East. And what I submit to you is that around 150 or 200 BC, there was a specific offspring of that cross-fertilization. Mahayana Buddhism, and specifically the Bodhisattva vow, is the child or offspring of the cross-fertilization of the Gnostic mysteries in the West and yogic and Vedic mysticism in the East. With, of course, the special strain of Buddhist philosophy that was injected into Asian mysticism in the 6th century BC. So I'm talking here in the shift of Swandeva, and this story is a narrative, a great sweeping narrative, presented to you in the spirit of Swandeva, she who instructs through vast, sweeping historical narratives. What you're hearing there in the background is the thunder resonating over the reed valley of the Guadiaro River in the torrential rains of the morning of the 4th of April, 2013. Now, with that historical picture established, I have two further details to specify. The first is that the idea of dana, or acquiring merit, came up and emerged simultaneously with the Bodhisattva ideal. See, previous to the Mahayana school and the Bodhisattva ideal, there was no real conception of merit or dana in Buddhism. For instance, it cannot be said that Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, acquired merit by delivering his discourses. He did not earn credit by talking to people and leading them toward their enlightenment. This could never be said of the living historical Buddha. But when the ideal or persona of the Bodhisattva comes into play, the idea of merit comes into play. And that is to say that it's stated in this way, to paraphrase, the Bodhisattva who refrains from entering nirvana in order to remain in samsara and act for the liberation of all sentient beings, thereby acquires merit. Bodhisattvas acquire merit. Buddhas do not acquire merit. See the difference? So wherefrom does this come, this idea of merit, dana? What is merit? Merit is like credits that a bodhisattva acquires. But why would a bodhisattva who is selflessly dedicated to bringing the world to the same state of enlightened liberation that he or she has achieved acquire or even want to acquire any merit or reward? It doesn't make sense. There's something here that doesn't fit. And I have to tell you that among all the Buddhism that I've studied, this concept of merit is the least understood, and it is handled extremely badly by Buddhist scholars. And I'm not sure that anyone in the school of Buddhism surviving today has the faintest idea what this conception means. Okay? I'll leave you with that outrageous and arrogant statement. And now proceed to my second point. The second point is that among the Prajna Paramita teachings, or sutras, which are generally listed as being 5, 6, 7, There is one of singular and supreme importance for Planetary Tantra, and that is called the Diamond Sutra. And it has a more extended name, actually, in Sanskrit. And since I have the translation right here somewhere, I'll tell you what that name is and why it is so important. The name is the Vajra Chedika Prajna Paramita Sutra. Vajra Chedika. Now, Vajra, as you know, Vivi, Vajra means thunderbolt, such as I'm hearing and feeling outside my window right now. Vajra means lightning, thunderbolt, but Vajra also means diamond. So Vajrayana in Tibetan Buddhism is the diamond vehicle. Yana meaning vehicle or instrument. Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle. So, Vajra Chedika. What does Chedika mean? Chedika means cutter. And actually, the correct translation of the Vajra Chedika Paramita Sutra is the diamond cutter. It's the diamond cutter. Isn't that interesting? It's the Diamond Cutter Sutra, Vajra Chedika. Now, look at a diamond. What is it? Well, you get a rough diamond. It's this highly crystallized stone, but it's rough. You put it in the hands of a lapidary artist, and what does the artist do? The artist cuts facets on the diamond. The purpose of the diamond cutter is to make facets. And this idea of the faceting of the diamond, which you might compare to the faceting of the ego aura that surrounds you like a soap bubble, as I described in NAB Briefing 56, is the essential metaphor to go to the heart of this instruction. The Diamond Cutter Sutra. And what does it cut? What does the diamond cutter cut? What does the diamond wisdom of the Bodhisattva cut? It cuts the facets. And who can cut the facets can also make them disappear. So, among the various Prajna Paramita Sutras is the Vajra Chedika Prajna Paramita Sutra, or the Diamond Cutter of Doubts, as it has been translated by the Buddhist scholar, Chinese Buddhist scholar, Charles Luck, or Lu Kuan Yew, on whom I relied for many years. So I've been reading Lu Kuan Yew since I was about 18. In fact, I didn't read anything for about 10 years in Buddhism, except Chan and Zen Buddhism, that is to say, Chinese and Japanese Buddhism. And I didn't veer over in the direction of Tibetan Buddhism till I was, well, I think in my late 20s. And that's when I got on the trail of Naropa and other venerable sorts of that kind, Longchenpa and so forth. The Diamond Cutter of Doubts is translated by Lu Kuan Yew in the second volume, no, in volume one of Chan and Zen Teaching. And along with it, he translates the lucid commentary by the Chinese Chan master, Han Shan. So you get the text of the Diamond Sutra with commentary. Now let's go directly to this material. What's so special about the Diamond Sutra, apart from the fact of its, the conditions of its emergence, the conditions of the origin of Mahayana Buddhism around 200 AD, corresponding with that crucial moment in the history of this planet when Gnostics came out of seclusion to openly address the world on the problem of salvationist religion and the problem of the lie of Jewish religion, of the demiurge, of the false, of the insane messianic program, and of the hideous insanity of Jewish master race theory. Apart from that significance, what does the Diamond Sutra have for us today? Well, the Diamond Sutra has a most extraordinary teaching concerning pretense, as I noted in NAB Briefing 56 on the My Encounter with Dhumavadi. The Diamond Sutra consists of an account, as do some sutras, of a dialogue, a back-and-forth exchange between the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, who is called the Buddha, the Enlightened One, and one of his close followers, in this case, Subhuti, H-U-B-H-U-T-I. And this conversation between the Buddha and Subhuti has the feeling of being something real and spontaneous, while at the same time, it is somewhat formalized and formulaic. It's formalized or formulized because it's been written down and preserved in a manner that can be repeated. But even within this structure, which is somewhat of a stilted and artificial structure, you can feel that there was an exchange that took place between the Buddha and one of his disciples, and that the sutra is actually the outcome of this exchange. I won't go into all the back and forth that took place. I just point out that Buddha in this context is instructing or advising Subhuti on how to handle his enlightenment, which assumes, by the way, that Subhuti has achieved the same access to nirvana as the Buddha himself, a very important point. And the Buddha is also advising Subhuti on how a bodhisattva behaves by not turning away from humanity and withdrawing into the sublime silent passivity of nirvana, but by remaining engaged. And so, I'll just read this one passage here where the Buddha says, presents the key point of the key point instruction of the sutra when he says to Subhuti, Subhuti, all bodhisattvas should subdue their minds as follows. Okay? That means that they should make the consideration of the following conditions, to subdue their minds or submit their minds to these conditions or these instructions. And this is what he says. Quoting the Diamond Sutra, all living beings born from eggs, wombs, humidity or by transformation, with or without form, either thoughtful or thoughtless, and neither thoughtful nor thoughtless, are all led by me to the final nirvana for the extinction of reincarnation. Although immeasurable, uncountable, and unlimitable numbers of living beings are thus led to the final nirvana for the extinction of reincarnation, it is true that not a single being is led there. Why so, Subhuti? Because if a bodhisattva still holds to the false notion of an ego, a personality, a being, and a life, he is not a true bodhisattva. End quote. And you'll find in the text, you can go to the Sanskrit if you want to dig it up, or you can look at the book that I'm citing, Charles Luck, Chan and Zen Teaching, Volume 1, page 161, the insertion of the word Laksana, L-A-K-S-A-N-A. Although immeasurable, uncountable, and unlimitable numbers of living beings are thus led to the final nirvana for the extinction of reincarnation, it is true that not a single being is led there. Why so, Subhuti? Because if a bodhisattva still holds to the laksana of an ego, a personality, a being, and a life, he is not a true bodhisattva. End quote. If you hold to the pretense of an ego, a being, a personality, and a life, you cannot be a bodhisattva. Such is the teaching of the Diamond Sutra. Now, you may wonder what your pretenses are, and you may wonder when the day comes that you have your meeting with Dumavati, and she sweeps away the pretenses that no longer serve you. But to prepare yourself for that meeting, consider this. It's easy to see, and even easy to say, that, for instance, if I were to see myself as a great rock and roll star, you could say that was a pretense. And you would say that is a pretense that is not borne out by my capacity and my actions. So call that a false pretense. Or you could say that I see myself as a really exceptionally good teacher. And you could say that that pretense, the facet of my self-perception, is borne out by my actions and my behavior. So that's a true pretense. But a true pretense and a false pretense are both pretenses. Can you see that? And while you concentrate on that notion, just consider the instruction of the Enlightened One in the Diamond Sutra. Do you think that you have an ego? That is to say, you have a social persona that distinguishes you from other people in social settings and allows you, therefore, to play a role in the theater of social activities. You think you have an ego. You think you have a personality. Your personality is the style of your behavior. You're charming, you're outrageous, you're vulgar, you're refined. This is your personality. Do you think you have a being? That would be, do you think that you exist as a concrete being? That would be having a genetic and physical foundation to your being, that you are someone whose existence is founded in a race, in genetics, in some kind of set of physical structures, that is your being as a human animal. You think you have that? You think that you have a life. You can remember, oh, the first events of my childhood, and this is my mother, and this is my father, and I'm a human being, and I have a social ego, and I have all these wonderful traits of my personality, and on top of it all, I've got a life. I know, because I can remember my life. I have a life memory that tells me who I am, and guess what? All of those are pretenses. So bodhisattvas liberate sentient beings by the thousands in countless numbers. But the primordial teaching of the Buddha says they don't liberate anyone at all. They're just liberating the original awareness power from the pretenses that have become attached to it. This is the teaching of the Diamond Sutra. And this is also, if you will, the instruction of Dumavati, although she does not instruct. You yourself put together this instruction out of a series of insights that come to you while she handles you, taking away from you that which you cannot remove from yourself. And that is such. Now, I would point out, as one of my pretenses, because I claim to be more brilliant at interpreting Buddhism than Buddhist scholars, that's a pretense. I'll leave it for you to judge whether or not I can back up that pretense. But speaking from that pretense, and with the great enjoyment that it gives me to do so, I'll point out that on 161 of this book, footnote 5, says, Laksana, Of course, this is a footnote on the line that I just quoted. If a bodhisattva still holds to the false notion, laksana, of an ego, a being, a personality, and a life, he is not a true bodhisattva, end quote. So, the translator and scholar deems it fitting to add a footnote, laksana, colon, form, appearance, indication, sign, aspect, and characteristic. Is that enough for you? I assure you, you can go on the internet and you can find 20 different definitions of laksana. And I say, forget them. I give you the definition of laksana that trumps all the others. Posture. Pretense. Everything is a posture. Everything you do is a posture. The woman making breakfast, the mother making breakfast for her children, is a posture. The mother who abandons her children and goes out to the crack house to get a hit rather than give her children breakfast is another posture. See what I mean? And that's not to say that it's the behavior what's in question. I'm not talking about the behavior. The question of release from the behaviors of pretending belongs to, properly, specifically, and exactly, to Tantra Mother. It's not the behavior, it's the facet of self-perception. Laksana. As I stand here now, in this room, recording this interview, listening to the rain outside, I'm in a posture. I'm standing up, my hands are free, I have a headset on, I move. Now I'm changing my posture. Now I'm sitting, I'm in a posture, a laksana. The postures are momentarily expressions of my behavior. And it is in the posture that I perceive my own behavior. So you can say, here's John Lesh in the middle of the night giving a navigator briefing. That's what I'm doing. That's my behavior. I'm teaching. I'm presenting a briefing. But I can't see myself teaching. I can't see myself presenting a briefing. All I can see is the posture in which I'm doing that. You see the difference? The posture, the pretense, is what shows me myself in my self-generated description of the world. Your lakshanas, your pretenses, show you yourself in your self-generated descriptions of the world. They are facets or aspects of your self-description. Pretenses are facets of self-description. So I can sit here and do recordings all night, and that's my behavior. I can do recordings until the early hours of the dawn, or I can go downstairs and dance to flamenco music, or I can go take a walk in the rain. Those are my behaviors and my activities, but my perception of myself doing that is my posture. And the bodhisattva's act of liberation is to see that the primordial consciousness inherent to every single human animal is free of the postures of that animal. Now, we need postures. We need pretenses, especially to interact in the tonal and in the ordinary world. And so, to cut to the chase and to put all this in plain and simple common English, the challenge here is to distinguish between those pretenses that are of merit and those which are not of merit. Or to use another syntax, what pretenses serve you and which do not serve you? But hold on for just a second here. Remember that this entire teaching, this body of instruction from Mahayana Buddhism, emerged simultaneously with the ideal of the Bodhisattva. Remember that. And the ideal of the Bodhisattva has been often spoken of as a path of service. You're in service to the liberation of all human beings. I'm telling you, you can't serve anything unless you enjoy yourself doing it. You can't really serve the liberation of all human beings unless you do it through the pretenses that are extremely enjoyable to you and that can in turn be enjoyed by others. That is the merit of a pretense, that it is enjoyable. Not only by the person exhibiting it, namely me in this instance, but by you too, who are on the receiving end of my pretenses, as I would be on the receiving end of yours. It's not about service. It's about enjoyment. And the unfortunate thing, and in some cases the tragic thing, about human behaviors, and especially about our meetings and encounters with each other, which causes things to go wrong, that unfortunate factor is due to holding to pretenses that you don't really enjoy anymore. But you can't let go of them because so much of your self-description is invested in them. And in saying that, in just saying what I said, I am paraphrasing the Diamond Sutra to you in the month of April 2013. It is truly astonishing and devastating and desolating to observe what human beings will do by way of self-sabotage so that they can hold on to their pretenses. That does not mean, by the way, that people who succeed in the world socially and who are able to assume an active and successful role in society are free of pretenses. excuse me, Mother McCree. Absolutely not. It's like I told the people at the Marian Institute when I made my first trip there. I didn't tell them from the stage as I was delivering my talk, but I told some of them in private conversation just exactly what I'm going to tell you now. It was obvious at that time that I was a great hit. I was a fantastic hit the first time I appeared in Marion, Massachusetts and talked with Graham Hancock. I spread through that congregation of people an enormous wave of euphoria. People were literally trembling from the euphoria that I communicated to them on the first hit of telestic instruction. And I enjoyed it, I loved it, but I was cautious as well. And so I said to one or two of the members in a private conversation, you know, you have to watch out in this world. It's wonderful if we all get along and hit it off and love each other. And I'm very happy to be received in this way. But you have to realize that in human society, people succeed because their pretenses agree with the pretenses of other people. People succeed because their pretenses match the pretenses of the people who support their success. And that's not the kind of success I want. So that's not the kind of success I can accept or ever did fucking accept. I want success that comes from my demonstration of my pretenses of the highest merit, dana, generosity. What does this mean? That if I'm a bodhisattva, let's just say on the wildest day of your imagination, oh, I'm a bodhisattva, okay? And I'm acquiring merit. Well, what the fuck does that mean? Does it mean that I look for a reward from what I do, from what I teach, from what I offer? No Buddhist scholar can explain in a satisfactory manner what merit is. Merit is simply the worthiness of an action that allows people to thrive together. So my pretenses are worthy and they are of high merit if they allow me to thrive with you, with others, in the realm of opportunity, in the realm of human society, where we come together to see how we can bring the best of ourselves out of each other. And that's how it works. That's enlightenment in action. That's applied enlightenment. It has no hierarchy. It has no structural or formal organization. It rests solely on one single and supreme shared desire, and that is desire to see the divine potential of the Anthropos emerge, flower, and thrive. This is the teaching that can now be extrapolated from the Diamond Sutra and the end and release of pretenses that do not provide the highest merit to one and all, to one and all. I don't want to do anything on this planet if it isn't of the highest enjoyment to me and affords the same and equal enjoyment to everyone else. I wouldn't bother to think about it. So that's how Kalika would take the teaching of the Diamond Sutra. Kalika would add the supreme element of enjoyment or pleasure. For as the Mahanavana Tantra says, the rites of the devotees of Adyakali are a pleasure to perform. Something you may consider as you reflect on the possibility of a date with Dhumavati. Something you may consider is this. You've got a lot of pretenses, pal, sis, bro. You've got a lot of pretenses on board. I've got a lot of pretenses. Everybody does. But which ones do you enjoy and can demonstrate for the benefit of all sentient beings? And which ones do you enjoy, perhaps in some sick way, even though they sabotage your life and ruin the opportunities that life brings you to live and love and thrive with others and through others, through others? What do you think I do with these NAB briefings and these books I write? What do you think I do? I live through the enjoyment and enlightenment that they give to others. I live through that. It's an extension of my life force. And the same principle is true for everyone. I told you, and I want to elaborate further, that last summer, I lived through a stunning example of a human animal who were turned down a golden opportunity coming from life itself to hold on to her pretenses, whatever they were. And I don't know what they were, and I don't care. It's not for me to know. It's not for me to judge anyone's pretenses, even my own, nor is it for me to make an inventory. Ruthlessness is not presumptuous. It is presumptuous to judge and make an accounting of the pretenses of another person. You can't even do it with your own. So stop. I make no judgment on her pretenses, but I can assure you that I was a witness to their destructive power, as I have been in my own life. How many opportunities, and I'm not just talking about a sweet night with some Latina nookie, but how many opportunities professionally and socially have I blown because of my outrageous pretenses? So in concluding this talk, just let me make two other points, if I can, in the remaining 10 minutes or so. If you go to the British Library online gallery of sacred texts on the internet, and you pull up the Diamond Sutra, this is what it says. Hidden for centuries in a sealed-up cave in northwest China, this copy of the Diamond Sutra, presumably a copy in a special collection at the British Library in London, is the world's earliest complete survival of a dated printed book. It was made in 868 AD. Seven strips of yellow stained paper were printed from carved wooden blocks and pasted together to form a scroll over 5 meters long. Although written in Chinese, the text is one of the most important sacred works of the Buddhist faith, which was founded in India. And there you have it. British Library, item OR.8210/P.2. The Diamond Sutra from Cave 17 of Dunhuang in China. How wonderful is that? You know that the Nag Hammadi codices are the first, earliest surviving example of bound books, aren't they? They are parchment sheets that were cut into small rectangles and bound together in a leather cover. That's the Nag Hammadi codices. And here, interestingly, amazingly, is another artifact from the spiritual heritage of humanity, which contains a message resonating so closely to the Gnostic and Telestic wisdom of liberation. I'm convinced that Mahayana Buddhism arose in the 2nd and 3rd century AD due to contact between certain Telestic masters of that era and accomplished scholars and masters of India, particularly those who were holding the teachings of Buddhism as their sacred heritage. I submit to you that Buddhism gets its concept of the Bodhisattva from the great teachers or fosterers, light bearers of the Western mystery schools. Had it not been for that cross-fertilization, the Indian Buddhist would not have known where to go with the experience of enlightenment. They would not have known what to do with their own nirvanic realization. And so when they met the Gnostic masters and they saw that there was an equivalent degree of enlightenment in the Gnostic masters, they listened to their Western counterparts, and the Gnostic masters said, "Hey, it's easy. We can also go into enlightenment. We also perceive and we have also reached not perceive, we've also reached the attainment of the primordial ground awareness in the same way that you have. But we do not turn our backs on humanity in order to dissolve ourselves into that voidness of bliss and ultimate knowing, which ultimately is a knowing of a not knowing of a no self that knows it is not a self, yet is the foundation of all self. We don't go there. We teach. We teach because it is our pleasure to do so. And that is the merit or dana of enlightenment. Sharing. Enlightenment is to be shared, and without sharing, there is no real enlightenment on this planet. So I have said, once again, speaking out of my pretension of being enlightened, I have said concerning the Rhonda moment, the only thing I can tell you about my enlightenment is this. It's yours. Does John Lash contain enlightenment in his pretenses? You bet I do. Does John Lash see himself walking around in this world as an enlightened man? You bet I do. I keep my pretenses right out in the open, but I'll tell you this. My pretense of enlightenment is entirely transparent. I don't ask you to look at it. I ask you look through it. And if you look through my pretense of being enlightened, guess what you're going to see? The only thing I can tell you about my enlightenment is that it's yours. You're going to see yours. How can it get any better than this? I don't know. That enlightenment which I sought all my life from such an early age, as so many of us did in that 60s generation, could turn out to be a communal affair is absolutely spectacular. That it could turn out to be a shared experience and not a single self-realization is something that surpasses my wildest dreams. So I am happy this rainy morning, happy to be coming through the breakthrough with Dhumavati and to be able to speak to you in this way. And in conclusion, I will just say this about the matter of pretenses. There is an oral teaching in Kala Tantra that you might enjoy savoring once in a while. You know, like one of those sour lemon balls of wisdom that you hold inside your cheek and suck on for a few hours. You know, there are three instructions in Kala Tantra, just as there are three instructions in Planetary Tantra, written instructions. But there are, in both Planetary and Kala Tantra, these floating phrases, these sayings that just come up spontaneously. And they are the oral or incidental teachings of the Tantras, of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. And one of those sayings that comes up in Kala Tantra is, enlightenment is just a game of pretenses. And whoever has the most transparent pretenses wins the game. That's about all you can say about enlightenment. It's a game of pretenses. A game. And So I'll leave you with that. You might want to consider that. You might want to carry that sour lemon ball on your tongue the next time you go to listen to some discourse from some Mahatma or the Dalai Lama or some other pompous ass in the hierarchy of Tibetan Buddhism or any other spiritual metaphysical program on this planet. As you sit at the feet of the masters today, you might want to consider that little saying from Kalatantra. And also, of course, if you do go along to sit at the feet of the masters, those enlightened ones who are perhaps, maybe not exactly coming out straightforwardly and telling you that they have the pretense of enlightenment, but they're allowing you to assume it. If you're going to go sit at their feet and suck up their wisdom, then you might want to consider that little saying. And also, don't forget to bring along a very big, buttery tub of popcorn.